Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff.
Live from Joe's mom's basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and happy birthday to Barry Manilow. While he may write the songs on today's show, we answer your letters. Plus, in our headline segment, the SEC has implemented regulation best interest for brokers. What does that mean for your money? We'll explain. And we'll take a look at Ally Bank's recent study on financial literacy with their Senior Director of Product Innovation, Emily Shalal. And yeah, spoiler, Mom says that y'all can stand to be a little more literate, y'all. But I'll brighten the day by helping Joe and OG throw out the Haven Lifeline, and I'll save time for some of my amazing trivia. And now, two guys who have their lunch pails out even though Mom makes them lunch, Joe and OG.
Even though Mom brings the lunch, I gotta have my Speed Racer lunch pail. I'm sorry.
It's the little things that count.
It's non-negotiable, man. Non-negotiable. Speaking of little things, welcome to a little show called The Stacking Benjamin Show. I am Joe Salcihi, Average Joe Money on Twitter. And across the card table from me, the guy who's not the fake OG on Twitter, it's the real other guy, or as we call him, OG.
What up?
Can you hear Mom vacuuming upstairs?
Not at all.
That's good. But she is, so she's cleaning the house. We're cleaning the house on your letters. We got a big old basket of letters that we're trying to get through.
Motor through before the end of
the decade.
End of the century.
Right. I noticed some of the letters still say, hey, while there's snow on the ground, I thought I'd ask you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Before air conditioning season.
Right. One thing that gets you a much quicker response is LinkedIn. Thanks to LinkedIn for supporting Stacking Benjamins. That wasn't very smooth, but we'll go with it. LinkedIn Jobs uses knowledge of both hard and soft skills to match you with the people who fit your role best. Post a job at linkedin.com/SB. Get $50 off your first job post. My brother just used them, by the way, and used our link for a job he was hiring for and got bunches of people. And he's like, we had to make the hardest decision. Literally this morning, he is in Northville, Michigan this morning, hiring somebody. And he said it was difficult because they got so many qualified candidates. Good stuff. Talk more about them later. But right now, we got some headlines. We got Emily Shalal from Ally Bank, your letters. So let's get moving.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamin's headlines.
Our first headline comes to us from Mark Schaff Jr. That's who it's written by. It comes from Investment News, an industry rag for brokers, financial advisors, general finance people. Brokers face heavy lift to implement Reg BI by next year. Mark writes, the clock's ticking for broker dealers to modify their operations to comply with advice reform regulations approved last week by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The implementation deadline is June 30th, 2020, but those 12 months could fly by for firms as they put in place policies and procedures required by regulation best interest, a measure designed to raise the broker standard of care from suitability. They'll have to examine sales practices, financial incentives, and material conflicts of interest while writing new policies and procedures and drafting new disclosures, according to Darren Domina, partner at Hayes & Boom. He says, while a year sounds like a long time, firms, especially large ones, are going to have to get started on this process relatively quickly. His reasoning was that regulation best interest applies on a transaction-by-transaction basis, and large firms sell many investment products. They'll have to come up with systems for disclosing and mitigating conflicts of interest related to those sales. The burden could be bigger for smaller independent broker-dealers who lack the compliance resources their larger brethren, said Fred Reich, partner at Drinker, Biddle, and Reith. The rule doesn't define best interest or mitigation, of course.
Why should it?
Nonetheless, firms are going to have to come up with ways to determine they've satisfied both requirements. In an Investment News webcast, Mr. Reich said brokers will have to institute mitigation and best interest procedures for each of their lines of business. For instance, annuities, mutual fund portfolios, and individual brokerage accounts. Where do you stand on this thing, this brand new SEC legislation last week, OG, this regulation best interest?
Well, I'll be honest, I didn't read too much about it yet. I've been waiting for way smarter people than me to dissect it, and then I'll comment on their comments. That's usually how I think about stuff. But also because we're already fiduciaries, and that is well above whatever the hell they're coming up with here. It doesn't affect me personally. The frustration is why didn't they just go all the way? Why do you have to just go, you just got to do this instead? Why can't you just say, do what's in your client's best interest and call it a fiduciary standard and make everybody act the same way? Instead, what you read there was, now you have to do what's in your client's best interest. We're not going to define what that is, but you have to prove the negative, right? If you're a broker, you have to be able to prove that you didn't not act in their best interest, if that makes sense. If anything goes to litigation, they didn't stipulate how that litigation is going to work. They didn't stipulate what defines best interest. So every company, every firm, every product, every office, a supervisory jurisdiction is going to have a different definition of what that looks like. And what is somebody's perceived best interest is another. It's just a different way of saying suitability. That's kind of how I hear it.
My feelings similar to yours, except reading quite a few voices on this. I kind of agree with a few people that I read, which is that with all of the watchdogs on one side saying you have to go all the way, your point of view, OG. On the other side, you've got all of the Washington, lobbyists.
Well, yeah.
For these brokerage firms saying we don't need to change anything.
Yeah, we don't need anything.
I kind of agree that this is about as good as we were going to get.
Well, maybe. And the only asterisk that I put on all of this is I guess we'll see how it all turns out, because we kind of went this way with the Department of Labor ruling, and there was a boatload of money that was thrown at getting rid of that, and it went away.
Yeah.
So the other thing that I kind of wonder is, and I don't know the legalities of jurisdiction here, but if you're a broker, you're not really subject to SEC guidelines anyway. You're subject to FINRA guidelines. So I just kind of am curious as to who.
Well, the SEC's in the background. I mean, no. If you get beyond FINRA, the SEC can still come down. We've seen the SEC come down on brokers before when there's huge fraud issues.
But if they operate on the fee side of things, yes. I don't know that I've ever heard of or seen the SEC come down on a broker who's acting in a broker capacity.
I wonder if we have attorneys working in that industry who might be able to weigh in for us. Write me at joe@stackybenjamins.com. I'd love to hear from you. You know, the other thing I think, though, so I started off by saying that this might be the best we're going to get. You know all this means if you're a client? Let's get on that.
Yeah.
More forms that people aren't going to read. These disclosures that are going to show some of the egregious fees you're paying sometimes. And the broker's going to find the clever brokers that are trying to get as big a fee as they possibly can are going to just say, sign here, sign here, sign here, sign here. You're going to sign all these forms. You're not going to read any of the red tape. They're going to laugh about, well, you know how you got 50 forms and none of them say anything. So I'm just going to go quickly through these. Just sign all these and you're good.
You know, there's a downside to using technology. And I've noticed this in our business and then in some of the other transactions that I do as well.
Oh, these DocuSigns?
Yeah. Yeah. So the good news is that it forces us to actually be done with them. And I know you did this and I certainly have done it years ago as well, where you go, listen, there's 64 pages here. I sticky tab the six that require your involvement, right? And if the client goes, yeah, okay, whatever, and then flips to page 16 and just initials, do you sit there and go through, well, on page 15, you'll notice subchapter 6, there's an arbitration clause. No, not really. You know what I mean?
I'll tell you what I was trying to do. I was trying to highlight like 5 or 6 of the things I thought were the big things they needed to know, just to make sure they knew that I wasn't just trying to...
Well, no, exactly. I feel the same way. But with the technology now, with DocuSign, it's just like you click it and it goes right to the next thing. And I was trying to do this real estate transaction the other day, and the real estate broker, she's conniving, as I'll get out. And I've told her repeatedly, I don't want a contract. You know, this is a one-time deal. You're not locking me down for 7 years or whatever it is. And then every time there's the broker contract in there that says, our contract goes on anything you buy and sell between now and June of 2020. I'm like, hey, we talked about this. Oh, yeah, sorry. That's an automatic form. I go, no, it's not. I know how DocuSign works. It's not an automatic form. Take it automatically out for me.
What's that? I was born at night, but not last night.
So there's some downside to this technology, but you're right. When it comes to the consumer facing side of things, first of all, there's going to be an easy way to explain it. If I'm a broker, I'm going to figure out a way to explain away. Yeah, I'm going to get this commission, but here's the good news, dot, 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 right? It's a one-time thing, or yeah, I know it's 5%, but the good news is you don't ever have to pay me that again. Isn't that great? Or whatever rationale they come up with.
I like that though, because at least they say it.
Sure. But you're more accurate in that there's going to be 72 more pages and it's just going to be press here, 3 copies, and off we go.
I know we're going to do the takeaways here in a minute, but I do think the important thing here is whether it's a real estate transaction with a broker transaction, a financial advisor, whatever it is, read the fine print just a little. And if you're in a long-term relationship with somebody, at least read it once so that the person you're working with across the table knows that you might read it at any point. Like I remember, don't get me wrong, I did things very above board, honestly, in my client's corner. But I knew that if you were checking the I's and T's, I was more likely to go through those with you every time because I thought that you might. If you didn't, and I could just speed up the meeting, I was going to do that. And I think it's in your best interest to slow it down a little bit.
Well, and that's why I think, again, on the independent space versus a big gigantic company, we have all the latitude to create the documents the way that we want them. You contrast, you know, an investment advisory agreement or a planning agreement that we use versus a big box company. While we certainly have the lawyers look at it, you know, I try to make it as plain English as possible. You know, just like a few pages, here's what's going on. That's that. Because nobody's got time to thumb through a 106 page prospectus, you know. And the reality is that even the brokers aren't reading it. So this is just another pile. I wish they would have gone the whole way.
And in our second headline, a new Ally Bank survey shows recent grads give themselves, get this, a C- in personal finance. That's not good, especially if you're a graduate. And you know what? We thought we would learn about the survey right from the horse's mouth. Emily Shalal, Senior Director of Consumer Strategy and Innovation at Ally, joins us. Thanks for joining us on My Dad's Shortwave, Emily. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell me what's going on here. How did this study work?
Ally is trying to keep a constant pulse on the state of the American consumer, just in their financial habits and thoughts and their attitudes, their behaviors, everything that they're thinking about money. So we wanted to go out and just get a pulse on how much people know about just managing their money and finances in general. And so we fielded this study and we started looking at the data in different segments, and we realized that the 18 to 24 year olds really don't necessarily have a good handle and don't think that they have a good handle on it. And they want to be better, but they're not really sure where to go.
In what kind of areas did you see that they're having a rough time?
So unbelievably, they underperform against every other adult segment except for having a budget, which is pretty terrible anyway, because only 40% of Americans have a budget or keep a budget on a monthly basis. But on basic things like paying bills on time, making regular deposits into an account, you know, seeking the help of personal financial money management tools that are in market, any category that you could ask, they underperform on.
This is worrisome to me because more than ever, I'm 51 years old, and to me, information's a commodity. If I'm graduating from high school, I've been using my phone forever, right? I know how to Google something or Bing or whatever they use. I know how to look it up on Instagram. I can look anywhere for information. Where's the disconnect?
Yeah, it's a little concerning for us too. I mean, I have a 14-year-old, and he spends more time watching other people play video games than he does play video games himself. And so for this generation that does have access, it's one of those things where I think we don't start talking about money early enough in our child's lives. And that's on the parents, that's on teachers in middle school and high school, that's on professors in college. And what we see is, even though there is a trend to get better, and I think it will continually evolve, it takes people seeking this information out on their own, and they really don't know where to start. And a lot of people aren't getting that direct you know, kind of advice from their parents. Because if you just think about the state of the American consumer, most people don't have enough money, you know, their parents to pay for an emergency, let alone teach their kids how to be better, you know, in their own right. And so I think, you know, at Ally, at least, we're trying to be more proactive in our communities to say, hey, money is important and start as early as you can. But we do have the information out there. We're not sure why kids aren't seeking it out. It is unfortunate that they spend more time reading ratings and reviews about the, you know, their iPod or their iPhone they're going to buy than seeking out how to keep out of debt when they start spending on a credit card. But, you know, hopefully, you know, we can build some programs and get better at it.
Well, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think this might be a bright spot in the study, is that more than older generations who don't want to talk about money, it seems to me, looking at what I have here in front of me about your study, they're open to talking to friends and family about study, these new graduates.
That's right. And so that is a good news story. And I think as long as their friends have a handle on money, that's a great news story, right? And as long as they're getting good advice from friends and family. And hopefully, and like I said, there is a trend to high school and college building more personal finance, you know, program and education into their content. And hopefully that trend continues. But it is good that there is definitely a more willingness to talk about money. And I think that's a great place for young people to start. Just having the conversation and starting to think about planning will start them in a good direction.
Well, I know, because you guys are in my new hometown, my old / new hometown of Detroit, that you guys aren't just studying this. You also have some tools on the topic. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so we have a couple of different tools that anyone can use. You don't have to be an Ally customer. So budgeting tools are great. Just understanding how much you need for retirement. Just knowing that number is important, even if you can't start saving for it today. Just being aware of what that is. So we have a lot of tools and calculators and educational content on our site. We also have a program called WalletWise that teaches personal financial management 101. And even if you don't want to come to Ally, I think, you know, just seek out those resources in general. But yeah, we think it's very important, and we want to make sure that even if you're not a customer, we're helping every American consumer improve in their financial lives.
Well, I checked out WalletWise, and it's so awesome. There's so many cool tools there. We'll link to Ally. We'll link to WalletWise on our show notes page today at stackybenjamins.com if people are out walking their dog or on their commute. Emily, thanks for hanging out with us and explaining the study. And hopefully next year I'm talking to you where the grades may be up to a B+.
That's right. Thanks, Joe.
You know, I like this idea. OG, and by the way, thanks to Emily for calling into the shortwave. I like this idea of creating your own curriculum, you know, design a curriculum for yourself. I remember Tom Peters, the management guru, talking about this very thing. Don't wait for your manager to train you to be great at whatever it is you're trying to achieve. Like, why do you wait for somebody else? Go do it. And it goes back to the first headline too. Maybe this is the big takeaway. Don't wait for somebody else, whether it's congresspeople, attorneys, your boss, whoever, to do it for you. Pick up the reins and do it, man.
Take ownership, right?
Yeah. I think that is the takeaway. No guest on today's show. Today's main guest is you.
Oh, me?
Well, not you.
I'm always the main guest.
No, not you. But you, the person out there walking the dog or on your commute, who wrote to us, we have a stack of letters. We no longer take letters because we got so far behind. There was no way we were going to catch up. If you call the Haven Lifeline, we're much, much more likely to be able to get to those. We'll have one of those calls a little bit later in the show. But first, we're going to kick it off with this fun one from Matthew. Matthew says, hey, Joe and OG, I'm 26 and have no debt, but I'm stuck with a credit score of 773. How do I crack 800 plus? I've never missed a credit card payment. I have no outstanding debt loans and have a very low credit utilization rate. Help. In all seriousness, I know my score is good, but I'm always willing to learn a thing or two. Good stuff. Good stuff there.
Well, I would say that you have to use the correct terminology here. If your credit score is in the 770s, it's not good. It's great. It's excellent. There's no perceptible difference other than, you know, at the nerd gallery when you whip out your credit scores to go from 770 to 800. But the reality is that the only way to do it is to actually consume debt. probably because you don't have any is probably the reason why you don't have an 800 or whatever score, because credit scores are not indicative of how well you are on a balance sheet, which you're great. They're indicative of how well you can manage payments from multiple places. And if you choose, like smart people, to not have payments, you're not going to be able to be scored in the capacity of how do you manage multiple payments. How do you get an 800 credit score? Go get a car lease, a mortgage, a HELOC, and then have a revolving balance on your credit card. But that's stupid. So I would, you know.
Well, I think there's another way to do that. I get all those. I think part of it is also his age. He said he's 26.
Well, that could be some of that too.
He might just have to be patient, number one, because it is the lifetime of your credit. But making payments on time, he's already doing. But to your point, if he uses the card every month and pays it off completely, that will help, which I think he's already doing. The other one is scary though, OG, which is that credit utilization. If he's 26, he might not have a lot of open credit lines. So even though his credit utilization might be, you know, a small percentage or zero of a number, that number might only be $2,000 or $3,000.
Yeah.
He opens up $20,000 or $30,000 worth of credit lines and doesn't use any of those. That'll get it up to 800. But once again, don't do it.
Why?
It's so stupid. Yeah.
Yeah. A credit score matters for this reason only. If you are attempting to borrow money in the future, then it matters what your credit score is. I was having this discussion.
It matters again. There's a different way. I mean, if you're at the bar and it's you versus somebody else.
There's like, you guys are both like gym models and you're trying to buy drinks for the one pretty gal. And she looks at one of you and says, okay, fine. Who's got the higher credit score?
Bam. 15.
It's like truck sizes. You have to have the pickup truck with the biggest wheels, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in all seriousness, I was having this chat with somebody who was worried about consolidating. It's $30,000 of credit card debt. Okay. And I said, well, why don't you go to Magnify Money and try to get a 0% credit card and do a balance transfer? Because you're paying 29% interest on 30 grand, which I'm just going to use some napkin math. 30% of 30, okay, 10 grand a year, right? You're paying $10,000 of your interest at Capital One. Why don't you go get a 0% credit card? And the person looked at me squarely in the face and said, I can't do that. That will hurt my credit score. And I'm like, and? So what? Well, then I might not be able to get a credit card in the future.
You kidding me? Are you not going to pay it?
Hold on a second. You would rather pay Capital One 10 grand a year to be able to reserve the right that someday in the future you could get a credit card if you wanted one. P.S. You suck at managing the one you have right now. You don't need another one. You have one that has 30,000. You need to pay that one off, you know? So credit scores matter if you're going to go get a loan. But other than that, unless it's trying to pick somebody up at the bar, doesn't matter.
Yeah, the goal is to not ever worry about your credit score. I mean, that
Steve Stewart, didn't he just recently say his credit score is zero finally?
It very well might have been because he hasn't used his credit in forever.
He hasn't used anything. He has no debt.
Yeah.
And hasn't for forever.
No debt. And credit line.
Yeah. Just zero.
Doesn't want any of it.
I'm pretty sure he's pretty happy with the zero score, which is not the same thing as a 350 score, by the way.
That is living the dream. 350 score. I'm on my way to zero.
Exactly. There's one way to do it.
Thanks for that question, Matthew. And I agree. It's all about beginning with the goal. What's the goal you're trying to reach and working from there? The next question comes just from Tyler. Tyler says, hey, Joe, I've been listening to the show about a year now, working on paying off debt. And me and my wife are both putting 10% into our 401ks. I want to know what your recommendations are on credit cards and rewards. Unlike some other Tennessee podcast financial show, you don't have issues using cards if they're used responsibly, but which kind of reward would you recommend? Cashback, miles, etc. Thanks. OG, what do you think about credit card rewards? Let's go into where we agree with Dave from Tennessee first.
Well, based on the beginning part of this question, I would say do not go Pasco, do not collect your $200. This is nothing you should worry about. You started out with, hey, I'm working on paying off my debt. What credit card should I use? Let me see. Zero of them. None of them. because you're still working on it. Now, maybe you mean student loan debt, or maybe you mean your home equity loan or something like that. But let's just assume that you mean credit cards or cars or something like that. Until you are a master of it on your own, then using the credit card thing, trying to game the system, is a sucker's bet. It's trying to beat the house. It's just not going to work over time. You might win one or two times, but you're going to lose over time if you're not already an expert at your own money. So I would say that from the perspective of where we agree, I love the baby step thing. I love the, you know, steps one and two and three of let's work on making sure you've got a good cash reserve, and let's make sure that you get your consumer debt paid off. And until you do any of that stuff, or all of that stuff, I mean, all the rest of it is just a fool's errand. You're not getting ahead.
That is a gentleman who clearly knows his audience and sticks with that message. The place where we may change things is we may consolidate debt to pay less interest to the man.
Yeah.
I'll also recommend sometimes people consolidate debt to get rid of the credit card, by the way. If you can't solve the root of the problem, what I used to do was help people cut up the card, turn off the ability to get a new card. I mean, shut down the credit card altogether by calling them up. You're still going to owe the money, but you have zero ability to use that card again. And then we'd get a consolidation loan, generally at a lower interest rate to pay less debt, gives them a consistent payment, and take care of the problem while we continue work on the root of the problem, which is how you spend money.
Yeah, the behavior is the most important thing. Once you get it all handled, once you have that cash reserve in place, and once you have your consumer debt taken care of, you may find out that it sucked so bad that you never want to do it again, which is a lot of times the lesson that people learn along this journey, which is, boy, it took me 4 years to dig out of that hole, or it took me 7 years to dig out of that hole. The last thing I want to do is give myself the temptation to get back into it by trying to get 100,000 bonus points from Chase or something like that.
It's a great lesson.
Absolutely, it is. So the question was, what reward programs do you like? I don't know, whichever ones you're going to use, I suppose. If you fly Delta all the time and you have a credit card that accumulates United points, I'd say that's pretty silly. You know, if you don't ever like going out to eat and you have a credit card that gives you bonus points on going out to fancy restaurants, I guess that would be pretty silly. So you have to find, you know, if you're going to use it, something that you would use, right? So if you'd use the cash back, some people love the card that deposits money into the 529. I think Fidelity does that, perhaps. That's going to be pretty unique to you.
I talk with somebody way smarter on this topic than either of us, Tyler. And that was Nick at Magnify Money, the head of Magnify Money. Mm-hmm. And Nick said that if you get less than 2% cash back, you're leaving money on the table. Airline reward cards are great if you are flying that airline enough that it gives you, you know, the upgrades, the luggage, but generally you can still get those with 2% cash back if you just move the money around. However, with some of the status points and upgrade points, it sometimes makes sense if you fly all the time to play that company's game.
Yeah, it's the stackable benefits on top of it, right? You know, if you fly a lot and you've got the American Airlines card that gives you free baggage and double points and da 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 da, then that's probably a good thing.
Access to the lounge.
Yeah. Yeah. All those things. That's a great thing. But the minute you pay 1 month worth of interest on a balance, all of the year's points is worthless.
Doesn't matter.
Probably 2 years worth. I would be interested to figure that out. No, I wouldn't be. I would be interested to read someone else to figure that out.
If you figure that out.
If you figure it out, the utilization of or the negative correlation between missing interest and the points on the average spend per credit card. There is some banker out there that does know that. That is their business. But anyways, my guess is that if you pay interest 1 month, you probably have burned up a year's worth of points.
Normally, we go to Doug's trivia here soon. We're gonna wait on that for a second. Instead, we're going to change things around a little bit, throw out the Haven Lifeline first, because we got a great Haven Lifeline question today. Our friends at Haven Life Insurance Agency, they put what you value first. While they say it's your loved ones and your time, Jeffrey in our basement Facebook group says, peace and quiet, said with our family of six, that's rare. Oh, and enough time to keep up with the amazing Stacky Benjamins podcast. Mm-hmm. Nice job, Jeffrey. Good work. I like that. Your loved ones and your time, or peace and quiet. That's why they've made buying quality term life insurance actually simple. Head to stackybenjamins.com/Haven Life now to get a free quote. It is super quick to do. It's all online. It's not the 45-minute thing that you may go through with an insurance agent. Prices are affordable. Policies issued by their parent company, MassMutual. It's more than 160 years old. Today, we're throwing out the lifeline to our friend Greg. Say hi, Greg.
Hello, this is Greg Moore. I'm sitting in my backyard in Florida. I have a question about a new brokerage account I opened. They offered me a checking account to work just like all other checking accounts. But when I initiate an ACH on day one, it takes them 4 days before they give me access to the cash. How can Fidelity get away with doing that? Thank you so much.
That is a fantastic question. Whenever you do these ACHs, you feel like your money goes into hiding for a few days. Explain that to us, OG. How does that work?
Well, I think there might be a couple of reasons, and I can't speak about the process that Fidelity uses or any brokerage account for that matter, but it might have to do with the relatively new relationship that you have with a company. So it could be that. It could be the fact that in conjunction with your brokerage account and your cash, if you're trying to ACH money in, they want to make sure that that money is legitimate before you turn around and buy stocks with it, because there's different rules with it when you are buying publicly traded companies, stocks or mutual funds or whatever, versus ACHing money into your checking account and then you go buy a cheeseburger at McDonald's, in terms of the legality of funds availability and that sort of thing. So there could be a hold there. There could be another reason, in that that's part of the way that Fidelity makes money, or a brokerage company makes money, is they can float your money for four extra days. And if they do that across their 10 million clients that they have extra access to that money where they don't have to pay you on it and they don't have to give you access to it during this period of time. And that's called part of their float. And then they're able to lend on it before they have to pay you interest on it, basically. Every little bit counts. But my guess is that it probably has to do with those two things. Oh, and then there's one other reason, and that Fidelity is really not the bank. In this example, Fidelity is contracting out the banking relationship to another company. It used to be called UMB Bank. I'm not sure if they use the same firm or not out of Missouri, but it used to be. In which case, it could be just simply a technology issue of they've got to get the information to UMB. UMB has got to get the information to the other company. The other company pulls the money into UMB. UMB has got to get the information to Fidelity. And it just takes an extra half a second along the way to reconcile all that data, basically. But I suspect it has the first two issues mainly involved. Number one, it's too new of a relationship that they're not going to trust that you're ACHing in $1 million and you go turn around by $1 million of Apple stock, and then, oh, shoot, that ACH got rejected or something like that. And now they have to unwind this big position. Between that and the timing of the availability of funds for the stock purchasing would be my guess.
I wonder if there's any money laundering stuff there, too, that they don't want to be inadvertently caught up in a money laundering scam.
Well, that's kind of what I mean about the new relationship thing. You kind of notice that just about in any place. I know that when we first started our business account for Stacking Benjamins, I remember I had three checks that we had to deposit. One was like $1,700, one was $1,300, and one was like $1,500. And the most they would let us deposit in 1 month was $3,000. And so I deposited the first two, and I'm like, oh, crap. And I had to like actually go wait in line at the bank. And I said, why can't I deposit this? And she just said, well, you know, you have to demonstrate your ability to process good transactions. You know, they're not going to just simply allow you to deposit a $1 million check on your phone day one.
A bunch of rubber.
Yeah, exactly. So, and over time that has increased, much like a credit limit would increase as you demonstrate your credit paying abilities and that sort of stuff. So I think that might have a little bit to do with it. Although I feel between that and the funds availability relative to stock trading, I think is probably the major issue.
I will say this though, ACHs are still way slower than they need to be for most transactions in the United States.
Oh, it is 100% a gimmick at banks. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That money is there. Like the whole like, well, we hold your check for two business days. I'm like, yeah, but it's, I see, like I move money from one account to the other. It's out. I see here. Let me show you. Yeah, well, we still have to hold to make sure the check's good. It's good. It's already come out of the account from which I drew it from.
It's completely gone.
They're like, yeah, that, but we still have to wait 2 days.
I've talked to FinTech founders about that. I've also talked to, you know, people in, whether it's brokerages or financial advisors that handle people's assets, and they're all frustrated. They're like, and most people, and you probably do too, OG, you have to warn people like, yeah, we're going to initiate this. And it doesn't mean you're going to have your money right away. You just apologize ahead of time. I mean,
meanwhile, I can Venmo somebody $1,000 and I don't even have to verify that it's the right person. Like they just go, yeah, this is the email address, right? You're like, yep. And you accidentally hit the wrong one. And now you're going, hey, so I accidentally Venmo'd you $1,000. And the other person's like, cool.
Thanks.
Bad for you, you know?
Yeah, the system has not changed. I've been out of the business for 10 years. I was in it for 16. The business hasn't changed. ACH hasn't changed since I began as an advisor.
Except that they have new regulations that you can't. So what's interesting, this is what I find really interesting about the ACH thing, is that remember a long time ago when you could like write a check, but you knew it would take 3 days for the check to clear. So you had kind of your own little float time.
Right. You write a check on Wednesday and you knew you weren't getting
really
paid till
Friday.
Because,
because the place that you deposited the check had to actually take it to their bank. Their bank had to mail it to your bank. Then they would draft it, you know, and process it. And then they would get the money back, right? So you had like a solid couple of days. Well, now they have this rule. Well, it's been around a while, but it's called Check 21, right? So that is the money goes in and it's immediately presented for, immediately, as in that day, presented for withdrawal electronically. So banks no longer have to mail the physical checks to the other institution anymore, right? So that got rid of the whole, I can write a check on Wednesday. Yeah, I gladly pay for you, pay two cheeseburgers tomorrow for one cheeseburger today, right? You know, you could do that anymore. Not that I would do that, but nor would you. You just knew people who would. Meanwhile, so you have to have the money available, but meanwhile, the bank can still hold on to your money for 2 days. You're like, but I know it clears in one night. Like, yeah, well, we got to hold it for 2 days. But I know that it clears in one night. Yeah, but you can have access to it in 2 days. Yeah. It's just, you know, it's a gimmick.
Thanks for the question, Greg. Great questions today, guys. We're all over the map, which I like. Head to stackybenjamins.com/voicemail if you'd like to leave a question on the Haven Lifeline. And you know what? You'll get a greatest money show on earth t-shirt code from our mom's friend, Gertrude, who helps us out with this stuff and in the basement. She's like the room mother, OG, taking care of everybody.
Yep.
StackyBenjamins.com/voicemail. By the way, if you have a question for us, remember, we said this at the top of the show, don't write us a letter. We can no longer answer letters. Get a little brave and head to StackyBenjamins.com/voicemail and we'll make it worth your while. How about that? All right. I think it's time for us to refill our coffee cups, OG. And we got Doug here waiting in the wings to talk more Barry Manilow with us. So let's head out and maybe get a celebratory second cup of coffee to celebrate our good friend Barry's birthday.
Hey there, trivia fans. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. And today, Joe's mom's blaring the Barry Manilow albums to celebrate his birthday. Not only does he have a career that spanned more than 50 years, he's also amassed an amazing collection of number one hits. But times weren't always great for Manilow. In the early days, he scraped by writing jingles for companies. He wrote the Band-Aids jingle, I'm stuck on Band-Aids because Band-Aids stuck on me, and performed the lyrics for companies like McDonald's, you deserve a, that's not at all what it sounds like, but you deserve a break today, you probably have heard it, Pepsi. All across the nation, it's the Pepsi generation and Kentucky Fried Chicken. How about this trivia nugget, though? Which popular insurance company owes their jingle, still used today, to Manilow from way back in the 1960s? I'll be back with the answer in just a moment.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, OG, my brother is in the middle of hiring people. And I mentioned that he should go to LinkedIn Jobs. And he took my advice. And by the way, he also used my code that we're going to share here a little bit later, and he had a ton of people And he's used other resources that we'll leave unnamed for today. But as you already know, OG, hiring's not as simple as putting an ad in the paper, posting to a job board. When you're juggling hiring and everything it takes to grow your business, it's important to reach those right candidates at the right time. And that's where LinkedIn comes in. We use LinkedIn here in the basement more and more to share our message about the shows. By the way, you can hook up with us on LinkedIn today. Just look up Stacking Benjamins, or you can look up me personally, and I'm happy to connect with you. More than 610 million members visit LinkedIn every day. Everybody wants to make connections, learn and grow as a professional, discover new job opportunities. In fact, LinkedIn members add 15 new skills to their profiles and apply to 35 job posts every 2 seconds. How about that? That's how they make sure your job post gets in front of people with the right hard skills and soft skills to meet your role requirements. Things like collaboration, work ethic, adaptability. I'd say when it comes to work ethic, oh geez, good on that. Collaboration, he's really good. Adaptability, not so much. LinkedIn does the legwork to match you to the most qualified candidates so you can focus on hiring the person who'll transform your business. To get $50 off like my brother did on your first job post, go to linkedin.com/SB. Again, that's linkedin.com/SB, and you'll get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, trivia fans. Well, if you're ready to take a chance again and get some of the hottest trivia north of Texarkana, you've come to the right place. We're spinning some Barry Manilow trivia in honor of the star's birthday. Here was the question. What insurance company owes its jingle, written in the 1960s but still used today, to Barry Manilow? The answer? If you said the jingle was, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. I nailed it. Yeah, you'd be right. What's your prize? Well, treat yourself to a weekend in New England. Maybe you'll meet a woman named Mandy who came and gave without taking. Or maybe you'll just be two ships passing in the night. Who knows? Either way, this trivia is BYOP. Bring your own prize. See ya. Hey, Joe, didn't you know Mandy was a dog?
Ooh, BYOP. You missed it. Like a good neighbor.
Yeah, I guess I would have got there.
Yeah, pretty iconic. Like, you think about all of the financial industry jingles.
What are you wearing, Jake from New York? Khakis.
I don't know that. What are you talking about?
Are you kidding me? The State Farm commercials where he's talking to a State Farm agent in the middle of the night and the wife comes down and goes, who are you talking to?
That's right. I love that one.
It's Jake from State Farm. And she grabs the phone and she goes, what are you wearing, Jake from State Farm?
Yeah, I'm married. Doesn't matter. You do that for me? Really? Yeah, I'd like that.
Who are you talking to?
It's Jake from State Farm. Sounds like a really good deal.
Jake from State Farm at 3 a.m. Who is this?
It's Jake from State Farm.
What are you wearing, Jake from State Farm?
Khakis.
She sounds hideous.
Well, she's a guy, so.
Another reason more people stay with State Farm. Get to a better state.
And there they just play the, they play.
There's the jingle. Yep.
Yeah. Good stuff. Let's get back to our letters, OG. And in the mailbag, our next letter comes to us. Let's see. From Philip. Philip says, hi guys, new to listening and enjoy hearing your take on finances and can actually stand to listen to you guys talk. I'm 19, married, great, going to school, hope to graduate in 2 years with my wife, and have less than 5,000 student loans thanks to Uncle Sam. I have no other debt and save about 15% of my income every month. Two questions. First, I have about $10,000 saved up aside from my emergency fund. Not sure what I should do with that, and currently have them in short-term bonds with the new Stash app. I know there's a better way to invest with it, but my risk tolerance is somewhat low because I want to invest in a house in a few years. So let's talk about that first before we get to the second question. What do you think? Anything better than short-term bonds?
Nope, not at all. You've got a specific time frame and you've got a specific goal, and that time frame is something less than 3 to 5 years, then it's got to be safe and secure. So short-term bonds are more than adequate there. CDs, cash, money market, anything that is virtually going to guarantee your access to those funds in the time period that you need them. You can't take any risk with this. So good job.
Great news about finance, Philip, is that being fancy sometimes gets you in trouble. Mm-hmm. So in this case, boring is way more fun, way better.
I would use a fund of hedge funds. Let me tell you. Just kidding. Psych. Just kidding.
Blue Star loves Anacott Steel.
That's right. Blue Horseshoe. But anyway.
Blue Horseshoe. No, it's blue.
Don't argue with me.
All right. Second question. I wanted to get your opinions on REITs because as a young investor, I'd be okay leaving a small portion of my funds in a REIT to earn that passive income. What do you think about REITs?
Well, if it's separate and distinct from the house down payment money, real estate is just another asset class. So there's good times with real estate and not so great times with real estate. The last 6 months, you look like a rock star if you have real estate investments. If you had them 2 years ago, you look like an idiot. So it belongs in your portfolio, whether it's publicly traded or privately held. I think probably for most people, the publicly traded version is adequate. Yeah, they pay higher dividends. Yeah, it's passive income. But usually the trade-off is if you get higher dividends, that means you get lower capital appreciation. You know, it's just all it's all money. It doesn't matter how it comes to you. But from a diversification standpoint, it's really important. So yeah, real estate's good in conjunction with everything else. So it's kind of a loaded question, but the short answer is yes. The longer answer is yes, but.
I think that distinction between private versus public is hugely important because back in the day, it seems like a lot of private REITs were offered out there. They're still offered in some circles. And with all the great public real estate investment trust available and the amount of time that you have to lock up your money in a private REIT OG, I think that it largely doesn't make sense.
Well, it doesn't make sense for a lot of reasons. It doesn't make sense in a private REIT because generally speaking, they're sold, not bought. It's just like an annuity and they have tons of internal costs. They have tons of internal fees and they seduce you with the high dividend, but you trade off any ability of liquidity. I mean, my goodness, there are still clients from the early 2000s that are holding on to stinking REITs that were, quote unquote, supposed to go public in 2010. And here we are in 2019, and they're still hanging out because there's just no market for whatever that REIT was invested in, and they can't exit it.
The reason they're not public yet is actually good fiduciary responsibility on the part of the people running it. They don't want to lose their butt, so they're going to keep it private for a longer period of time. That part makes sense. The bad news is if you needed the money when they said they thought they were going to give you the money.
Yeah, you're a decade removed from the liquidity. Exactly.
Yeah, you got to remember that with any real estate transaction. I mean, whether it's, and people that listen to the show know how much I like things like AcreTrader as an example. I'm a fan of that model, but your money is locked up. And if you're looking at any liquidity with that money, you need to be aware that things can change at any point in time with that type of investment. I mean, real estate, you can't sell off a bathroom of a house to get at that cash. And as long as you're comfortable with that going in, I think you're good. The other thing about private REITs OG is that in some of those private opportunities, you are in on the ground floor largely. If it's a phenomenal opportunity, it's not going to be open to the average Joe investor like you or I. Those private real estate opportunities, if they can get a big sum of money from a single person, I mean, unless they're part of their business model is democratizing the process or investing for all or whatever it might be, unless you see that, my question always, especially with some of these big real estate development deals that you'll see, why are they asking you for cash?
Exactly. By the time they get to John Q. Public, if they're still raising money and it's such a phenomenal deal, they've asked the millionaires and billionaires already at that point. You know what I mean? Like they're on to John Q. Public for a reason.
Right.
And they're not altruistic reasons, by the way.
And on that note, by the way, so that people don't then write me about, well, Joe, what you just said about AcreTrader. So why do you like AcreTrader then? AcreTrader's rate of return is not high enough for those people. You look at the rate of return that AcreTrader pays. The people that are getting the quote hot deal are looking for something way more sexy than farmland paying cranking out 8%. I mean, they're just, that does not light up the person who's going to write that big check.
Yeah.
Thanks for that question about REITs. North American REIT Index, the NAREIT Index, and the S&P 500 OG over long periods of time, pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
Our last question today is going to come from Leo. Leo says, due to lower income tax bracket and higher income in 2018, we were hit with an underpayment penalty for not withholding more than 100% of 2017 taxes and 90% of 2018 tax bracket. I've heard you guys talk about the best thing to do is to withhold a dollar more than what you owe. Where does this dollar come from? How do I withhold more taxes? What is Form 2210? I promise I won't learn anything from you guys, but your answers are still quite entertaining. I like how he saves the form number to the very end.
Yeah. The underpayment safe harbor rule is 110% of last year's liability or 90% of this year's liability, you're okay. So if you earn more than that, if you have a really big year of income, the way to get out of accounting for that, let's say that you won the lottery. Last year you made $100,000. This year you won a $10 million lottery and the state didn't withhold any taxes when you won it. As long as you withheld 110% of last year's number, even though this year you made 20 times as much money, you're going to be okay. So that's always the rule of thumb. If you have a job that is a commission-based job or something that you can control your income and it's going to be a little bit higher, you want to make sure that at least you hit that. Or, you know, as you calculate it throughout the year, make sure that you at least withhold 90%. The IRS wants their money now. They don't want it in next April, whenever you get around to paying it. The best way to account for this is to make sure that you're working with a good tax preparer, a good CPA, because if you're in a business that's just a straight, flat, boring W-2 job that is pretty easily predictable and you get a regular bonus, then you can just go on the IRS website to the W-4 calculator, put in, here's how much withholding I've had for the year, here's what my paycheck looks like, here's what my tax forms look like from last year, and it will calculate for you. Here's what your withholding should be. You should be single in one. You should be married in three, whatever. It will help you figure that out. If you have more variable income than that, where let's say your income bounces around a little bit, it's a commission job, or you get big bonuses infrequently or something like that, you want to make sure that you're working with a tax professional who can help you throughout the year. Again, the IRS wants their money spread out evenly, but not often do you get paid evenly, especially in those kind of lumpy commission type positions. So there's ways around that too. You can say, well, no, I earned this last 80 grand December 18th. That's when I got that check. It wasn't spread out over the year, and that can help offset some of those penalties as well. Something that just kind of a routine TurboTax wouldn't necessarily catch, but perhaps a CPA might. So I would say that if you expect this sort of variation in the future, you probably want to engage a good tax person to help kind of guide you through it throughout the year.
At the very least, OG, if they're using tax software, can they get partway through the year and try to do an estimate on that?
Well, if you have bouncy income, and let's say that this year you made 100, but next or last year you made 100, but this year you think you might make 200 because you sold more tractors, the get out of jail free card is at least 110% of last year's number. So as long as you do that, you know, you just have to look at your tax return from last year and say my total liability was 41,000. So as long as you withhold 46,000 this year, you're good. Even if your total bill is 100 grand, you're not going to pay an underpayment penalty. Now, you still have to come up with that other $60,000, which probably makes sense that you should withhold that throughout the year so you don't have to like come up with it. But if you're just talking about purely underpayment penalties, that's how I would kind of think about that.
Thanks for the question, Leo. And if you've got a question, of course, head to the Haven Lifeline, stackybenjamins.com. And at the top of the page, you'll say questions for the show, or just head right to stackybenjamins.com/voicemail. That's going to do it today. It's great questions today, OG. We were talking credit, tax withholding, credit cards, paying off debt. It's people getting ahead on this show.
We do what we can.
One more small piece of business here, and we want to shine the light on somebody who left us a review, and that helps people who are new to the show understand what they're getting into when they listen to Stacking Benjamins. Mom's got this on her refrigerator, OG. Joe and OG Rocket by Clipper Fan. not the best year, OG, to be a Clipper fan.
I'm not sure. Don't remember if they made the playoffs or not.
It's always the best year, though, to root for your team. Always the best year. And there's always next year, too, Clipper fan. Clipper fan says, Joe and OG are awesome. I'm listening to them now as I type this. They're regularly joined by Len Penzo and Paula Pant as well. Fun and fast pace. I keep learning stuff, even though they tell me not to. The transitions to sponsors are sometimes cringeworthy, but Joe takes time to make sure his sponsors are worthy for his listeners. Subscribe to his Facebook group, and sometimes Joe'll reply and leave a comment. Lots of cool stackers to ask for advice. That's all true. And OG, you're there sometimes as well.
On occasion.
Hanging out. Pictures of films about roofers and about presidential planes landing on runways.
It wasn't landing. It was landed.
It was landed. Did they actually tell you to stay away from the plane?
You didn't need to be told. The barbed wire and the big signs that said stop, federal area restricted. Also, the counter snipers in the bushes probably were a motivator.
Wow.
Of course, we didn't see the snipers. I just assumed they were there.
You just knew that they were there. Yeah. Right.
I did hear a story about somebody who did try to get close to the plane.
And it didn't work out very well.
It didn't work out very good for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But thanks for that, Clipper fan. And mom is very proud of that. So thanks for giving her something to brag about. All right. That's going to do it for today. Doug, take it from here, man. What should we have learned on this episode?
Sure thing, Joe. And check this out. I've got the perfect segue on Barry Manilow Day. Looks like we made it. No, nailed it again. Okay. I'll tell everybody what they should have learned. First, take some advice from today's headlines. Don't wait for someone else to teach you about money. Create a financial curriculum for yourself. Find your favorites among our guests and follow their work. Read books that explore different angles of financial investing and expand your horizon. Second, worried about your credit score? Pay your bills on time. Increase your credit available to usage ratio. And wait, well, those are the three main ingredients to a great score anyway. But the big lesson? It's best to just keep small children and pets away from the house on Barry Manilow's birthday. Joe's mom? Yeah, well, we can't smile without her. We also can barely live with her when she's singing Barry. Holy cow! Mom, my ears are bleeding. Lay off it. Ah, we love her anyways. Special thanks to you for sending your letters. While we can no longer answer written emails on air, we can invite you to ask your questions for OG and Joe on the Haven Lifeline. Head to stackingbenjamins.com/voicemail to leave your question, and you'll be on the show in no time. Thanks also to Emily Shalal from Ally for stopping by. For more on Ally's personal finance study and more, head to ally.com. This show was created by Joe Saul-Sehy, produced by Richie Rutter-Reese, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. Online, visit us on Twitter at SBenjaminsCast or on our Facebook page. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and I'm a lot deeper than you realize. In fact, sometimes I just stand in front of my mirror and reflect. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remuneration. There's no way you would take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only, and before making any financial moves, consult with a real financial advisor.
I've seen a few movies lately, And this one I saw actually, a couple of weeks ago. Still in theaters, though, although it's flown under the radar. This film, which is produced in part by this little known guy named Will Ferrell and is directed by a little known person named Olivia Wilde. This film is called Booksmart.
It's the last day. We got you through high school.
I need to go over the end of the year budget numbers.
Can't we just graduate, head off to college? That should do it, right?
We will persist.
I can't hear you. I can't soundproof glass.
We have to go to a party tonight.
What?
Nobody knows that we are fun. We didn't party because we wanted to focus on school and get into good colleges.
And it worked.
But the irresponsible people who partied also got into those colleges.
I'm incredible at hand jobs, but I also got a 1560 on the SATs.
We haven't done anything. We haven't broken any rules.
Name one person whose life was so much better because they broke a couple of rules.
Picasso.
He broke art rules.
Rosa Parks.
Name another
Susan
one.
Susan B. Anthony.
God. So
this film stars two young women who are very book smart. They have studied hard, and to a large degree, at least one of them thinks because of that, she is way better than everybody else. And as you heard on the clip, OG, they all of a sudden realize that while they were having no fun because they were focused completely on the next stage of their life, that all these other people that were having tons of fun in high school, well, they were also going to good schools, and they decide that in one evening, the night before they graduate, they're going to have to make up for a bunch of lost time. And so they decide to go partying. You heard the voice of Jason Sudeikis. He is the principal in the school. You didn't hear Will Fort and Lisa Kudrow, who are pretty hilarious as one of the two young women's parents. This film I went into with kind of low expectations. I saw that it had a good Rotten Tomato score. Also, a friend of ours in the blogging community, shout out to Kelly Whalen, who watches a bunch of films, said that she really liked it. So this is going to sound really strange because this is the kind of movie my wife would normally drag me to. I dragged her to it. There was really nothing else on. And so we went. This was a blast. I really, really, really like this movie. And I'm sad to read some reports that say that this film hasn't done very well at all at the box office, because I think it certainly deserved to. It's funny. Characters are endearing. They learn a bunch of lessons. This is one of those high school coming of age movies that, oh, gee, we grew up on. Well, I don't know. Did you watch any of the John Hughes movies?
Who's John Hughes?
Oh, boy. Yeah. This is another in a long line of movies that OG's going to miss, even though I'll tell him that he really should see it. Somebody in our Facebook group said that. They're like, I love the number of times that Joe says, go see this movie. And even before Joe's finished with the description, you already know what OG's going to say. Yeah, neat. Fantastic.
What other movies did John Hughes do?
16 Candles.
Oh, God. We're in a different generation, but go ahead. What's the next one?
The Breakfast Club.
Definitely a different generation.
All right. Well, there you go. We'll just stop right there.
Thank you.
So some good films. All right. Mm-hmm. Go see it, though, OG. I'm going to tell you right now, go see it. You'll really like it.
Okay, sure. Let me schedule it. Schedule this. Go see Stupid Movie. And
Never.
Got that. Take the bus to Never Town and get off at exit. No, got it.